Hello, my dear friends, and welcome to another episode of Past Lives. I'm your host, Patrick Wyman. Thanks so much for being here today. I think there are basically two kinds of people who enjoy history. First, there are those who like it because they want to know what happened. And second, there are folks who like to explore the past because they like inhabiting other worlds and meeting people who aren't like themselves. That's not mutually exclusive. You can and probably should do both. But it's fair to say most people are going to come down more on one side than the other. For those of us who embrace the second option, because we like seeing other worlds and other ways of being, history is a never-ending source of inspiration. I found myself understanding 21st century politics better because of a throwaway line in a book on the Wars of the Roses, grasping something essential about the drive to power from thinking about Roman consuls, and most of all, imagining better fictional worlds than most of what entertainment media has to offer. That's why I am so excited to talk to today's guest, because her fantastically enjoyable fiction uses so much more of our shared human past as a canvas on which to work, specifically the medieval Islamicate world from North Africa to Southeast Asia. Shannon Chakraborty is an award-winning New York Times bestselling author of the David Badd trilogy, The Adventures of Amina al-Sirafi, and now The Tapestry of Fate, all of which I highly recommend to you all. I cannot remember the last time I've had this much fun reading fiction. Shannon, thank you so much for being here on Past Lives.
Thank you so much for having me. I've been a huge fan of your podcast for years.
First of all, I'm going to turn the brightest shade of red, so thank you. But I'm so excited to chat with you today for a whole bunch of reasons. But the first and biggest one is the thing I enjoy most about your novels is how deeply imagined these fictional worlds are. So when you're thinking through these times and places, what inspires you the most when you're thinking about parallel worlds or source worlds? What comes to mind for you?
Honestly, I think I was an overly curious child who just never lost that ability as an adult. I've always loved history. I've been joking on my book tour. If you want to know how I feel about history, I dressed up as a Titanic survivor for Halloween when I was 11. And that was before the movie came out.
I have to know, what was the impetus for that? Like, where did this Titanic obsession come from?
Probably because I was one of those nerdy children who was turned loose in libraries and just picked up books. My grandmother had won a copy of the World Book Encyclopedia when I was very young and we had it in my house. And I would just go through certain pages and be like, I'd like to learn about Crete. What is a Minoan? And then just go down a rabbit hole. So I largely now have my dream career where I get to imagine these places that made me so curious. And I have a problem limiting inspirations. I have an entire list on my cell phone that I keep. I'll hear a certain time and place. I'll be like, oh, that sounds really interesting. I wonder what those Neolithic monuments on Sardinia are. I wonder what they were used for. I wonder if I could set a story there. I'll hear a little thing about a discovery of, you know, this family of exorcists in the Neo-Babylonian Empire. And immediately I'm going in my head, what were their lives like? How would I imagine that? So I find inspiration to be the easy part. If I had any wish in this world, I would love to time travel and to see, I mean, granted, with the ability to speak the languages and a great dose of antibiotics, vaccines, all of those things. But I love imagining past worlds and the fact that I get to recreate them and just dive into all of the history and research that I love feels like a dream.
One of the things that stands out the most is the level of your engagement with real historical worlds, the real historical worlds on which you're basing your settings. It is absolutely outstanding. I mean, because you're getting not just to the details. Like, I think a lot of the time when people do world building and they're drawing on history, they're looking for small details of like how a ship was rigged. But you're using it for something much deeper than that. You're getting whole animating concepts out of the past. So when you're writing a story and you're thinking about where do the conflicts come from, where do the characters' ways of being and understanding the world come from, it strikes me that that's as much what you're getting from history as these smaller details. And that's a much deeper way of engaging with it.
Absolutely. I think historical fantasy, this is a broad term for everything from secondary world inspired fantasies that maybe somebody is working through their own culture's folklore, but it's very clearly a secondary world. Or you have other stories that are inspired, but again, just the details are loose. And there's no right or wrong way to do that. But I think if you're getting into the kind of historical fantasy where you are saying, this is our world, I think that should often come with a different level of responsibility. for those of us who are kind of working in historical fantasy, I think we're painting a picture of history for a broader audience than maybe we want to really think about sometimes. If you're working in video games and movies, TVs, popular commercial novels, those are going to be read and consumed by a very wide audience who is then going to base their understanding of the past off of those imagined histories, right? We can all pretend this doesn't happen, but that is exactly what happens. It's easier to go play a video game than access a graduate level history course. And I think that's fine. I want people to love history, but I think we should be very careful about the worlds that we're putting on the page and we're putting out to the audience. Very often they are just there to sort of further misconceptions about the past. If I say the word Viking to many people, the image that is coming to them is based off of a TV show, not based off real history. And that sort of colors the perception of what these worlds were like, that very often they were more diverse, they were more interesting, they were weirder in their own perception. I mean, I love talking to people about the medieval world because they always think, oh, it's dirty, nobody washed, everyone's dressed in brown. And of course, it's not that at all. I mean, right now we have the Odyssey coming out this summer and we see, again, sort of a look of the movie that is very, everything is leather and grim. Of course, that's not what people would have dressed like, would have looked like. And I think sometimes when we flatten those wild and weird edges, we lose a lot.
You hit on a distinction that I come back to all the time when I'm thinking about historical fiction, but it applies even more so to historical fantasy, is the distinction between a costume drama and something that actually inhabits the world. Because it's a question of, are you dressing up your characters in period garb, but they're essentially modern people acting in modern ways, or are you actually inhabiting the world? And in the case of your work, it's very clear that you are inhabiting the actual world. Your characters are constrained by the norms of the era that they live in really profound ways.
Yes, and I wanted to do that because I wanted to engage with the history. To take The Adventures of Amin Asarhadi, for example, I love this time period, but I also kind of wanted to wrestle with a lot of the sources we have, because we have all these tales of chroniclers and journeyers, of course, Ibn Battuta is the most famous, but very often we're left a record of privileged men. And they go around, they're, you know, insulting the local women and saying the sailors who carry them everywhere don't know how to properly prepare meat. And we get a very different look. Ibn Battuta hated the pirates off the coast of India that show up later in my novel. And I wanted to kind of engage with those sources. Who do we let tell these stories? I wanted to see some of those characters tell their own stories, the working class, the local women, the lewd local women, and kind of examine the way those tales were put together. We have so many rich voices from this period. I just really wanted to capture their vibrancy. Talking about perceptions of the past, I'm very aware that many of my books are circulating around the lives of historical Muslim women. What did life look like to live in these societies as a woman? Because I guarantee you, it looked a lot different than many people think. And I've always been captivated by these historical people, and I just really wanted to put their lives and their attitudes and their loves and their stresses and their humor on the page.
Speaking about representations of women in historical fiction, it's so hard to walk the line between understanding the ways in which women's agency in the past was circumscribed by gender norms, while at the same time giving them the agency that they actually had. The women in your stories are constrained by the gender norms of the world they inhabit, but they're not powerless. And it's so hard to hit that real sweet spot, to kind of thread the eye of the needle. But like, your female characters do that. It's really stunning and cool to see.
Well, thank you. I think it comes down to the fact that people in the past did not live their lives so that hundreds of years later, we could look back and put our own norms or politics on them. This was something I came back to in writing a story set during the Crusades, but in which the Crusades are not a major player. None of the women in these novels are living thinking that they're necessarily constrained. This is the society that has shaped them, and they're finding ways to live in that. And yes, sometimes to rebel against it, sometimes to work throughout it, but it is their society and their life. And I think I'm not one to paint a rosy picture about the past, especially not after the last book I wrote, sort of tangled deeper with the idea of conquerors. But women have always tried to make a life for themselves. All people do. It doesn't matter that you live in an era where, God forbid, the life expectancy and infant mortality rates are entirely different. Humans continue to strive to live, to take care of their children, to kind of seize a life for themselves, to do right by their family. I wanted to very much capture that feeling, not sort of by putting my own modern lens on it.
I can't tell you how many times over the years as a historian, I have to deal with ideas that have gotten into people's heads from fictional sources, like Braveheart and Prima Nocta. I can't tell you how many thousands of times I've had to deal with that. I did have a student ask me in what historical period Game of Thrones took place. Not in the sense that like what inspired it, but when did this happen? Because she thought it was history. She got an A in the class. She was great. She was a fantastic student. But to your point, she really didn't know. She had not read a lot of history, and it was not clear to her what was fiction and what wasn't. And so to your point of responsibility, not that George R.R. Martin needed to make it clear that the dragons weren't real, but at the same time, like, she had misconceptions about the Middle Ages on the basis of having watched Game of Thrones.
Yes. And I think that happens a lot. And I think it's, you know, it's one of those topics that I think people get very prickly about. And there's really no reason to. I think we can encourage a spirit of curiosity, of learning more, of sometimes being like, oh, I got that wrong, right? Like, I'm sure I got aspects of history wrong. That's amazing. We're constantly learning new things. That's something to prize. And I think that's just something that those of us who are in that space should sort of wrestle with before you put something on the page. I learned a lot. I was quite humbled by the historian I worked with on issues of magic and gender because, you know, she kept coming back to me about like, you need to normalize this more. This was magic is an everyday part of people's lives. It doesn't matter what religious prohibitions it was coming up against. It existed. We talked a lot about gender, about the conceptions of which stories can you tell when you have evidence staring you in the face. You have to present that evidence and those lives, even if it comes into conflict with what modern readers might think about that period.
I think a lot of the time when people talk about norms in the past or like, well, this is how it was supposed to be. Well, norms existed in large part because they were trying to corral behavior that went beyond the bounds of those norms. Like, this is the problem with using legal sources to write about the lived experience of history is legal sources are normative and people aren't normative. People's behavior is not normative. People are just out there doing stuff all the time. And those kinds of sources, when we have access to them, they're valuable, but they're not what people were actually doing.
No, they're not. And it's interesting because another thing I sort of think when it comes to legal records is legal records are great. First of all, that I write about criminals. So I would like to put out my appreciation for legal records. But I do think a legal record exists when a person comes into contact with the state. And historically, or nowadays as well, that typically doesn't go well for a person, especially if they're coming from a marginalized background, especially if they're doing something which is conceived as not out of the norm, but forbidden. And I think I like to look at those individuals and think, what happened before they came into contact with the state? How might they have conceived of joys in their lives, of these acts or other things that the state is not very happy with them about? But I think historical fantasy lets us do that in a way that if I'm a historian, I can't imagine, oh, what was life like for perhaps this person who today would identify as queer, you know, when they've come into contact with the state. As a historical fantasist, I can try to think about their life beforehand.
I love that so much. And it reminds me very much of something Deb Harkness said when I was a graduate student. I worked with Deb Harkness, who's written a whole bunch of best-selling like vampire novels that are set mostly in the early modern period in the present. And she said, the great thing about writing fiction is that when I don't know the answer or when I would just have to say, well, we don't know, in fiction, I can just say what I think is right. I can imagine that and I can just put it on the page and that's okay.
Exactly. And that's part of the joy of it. Although I think it's interesting sometimes working with historical fantasy, I've just had a whole experience with this. I'm writing the third Amina book and it takes place largely in Egypt. So we have the medieval world coming into contact with what they knew of ancient Egypt. And I've just really been trying to figure out, okay, at what point do we truly lose the ability to understand and inscribe ancient Egyptian? And there's a whole debate about this. And I was reading a lot of scholars talking about, you know, it could very well be later than we think. There are accounts of Ibn Tulun, who's one of the first Muslim governors of Egypt, having this old Coptic man who used to tell him stories. And I was going back and forth like, yes, I could probably make an argument. There's a secret group of people or monks up in the cliffs that might still understand this knowledge in the 11th century, the 12th century. But do I want my readers to take that journey with me? Because I feel like if you push people, at least for my books, if I'm pushing them too far out of this is probably not likely, then they're going to doubt the other parts of the history I'm presenting that I do know rest on a more solid ground.
It strikes me that as we're talking about this, you're showing a really sophisticated historical sensibility in the way that you go about looking at these worlds. So what's your background in history? I mean, how did you get into this and why the medieval Islamicate world?
So I've always been interested in history since I was a kid, but unfortunately, I didn't go further than my undergraduate degree. I wanted to go back to graduate school to study specifically the medieval Islamicate world and sort of the wider Indian Ocean world. It didn't happen for a lot of reasons. And for many years, I was very self-conscious about saying that. And now I'm trying to be open about it because I think my example and other people working in this show, you don't have to have an advanced degree to appreciate and love history. We live in an absolute glory age of public history. I think we're just so fortunate. We have podcasts, we have digital records, we have translations, we have scholars who are doing literally just that, saying, I want the public to be able to access this history. You don't have to have a degree to understand and appreciate this stuff. I think you need to be a bit savvy, because for a very great history podcast, there's one about how aliens built the pyramids. You need to do some questioning and be a bit savvy about that. But I don't think we should let that stop us. I get questions a lot from readers who are, there's like a suspicious edge of like, well, how, you know, all of history is biased. They say yes, but that's okay. And that's something to sort of embrace and just, again, be open to learning more, to listening to people who might have a different perspective. That's my background, but I really got interested in the medieval Islamicate world sort of by happenstance, and it's also a great story. I was studying abroad in Cairo, and I took almost like by accident, I don't know how I got put into this class. I needed to get a certain number of credits to keep my scholarships back in the States. And I got put into a graduate level course on the Indian Ocean, medieval Indian Ocean world, exactly what I study now. And I was just fascinated because we have just so many more primary accounts than I would have thought. And I think I've mentioned in a lot of my interviews about the Cairo Geniza. And the Cairo Geniza was the first sort of collection of documents that I really started studying. And it is a collection we have, essentially in Jewish law, you are not allowed to just toss out papers that have the name of God written on it. And something people did a lot in history was write the name of God on everything. So we have this repository of accounts from like a 9th century, maybe even earlier, up to the 19th. And they are the lives of everyday people. They are people squabbling about that their son-in-law is a lout and doesn't do enough on his travels, arguing over dowry concerns. We have letters regarding Maimonides and the loss of his brother at sea. They are truly, I mean, everything from a businesswoman who's had a son out of wedlock and is now trying to negotiate a new contract for something and talking about the rabbi she really appreciates to just ideas about, you know, medical health. And it's this repository of regular people. And I remember reading this and just being completely taken aback. And not even just of Jewish lives, because Christian and Muslim Egyptians, they were living very similar lives, especially the common people. And it really just opened up a world to me of so many similar voices of people who are writing books about charlatans, about doctors who are traveling there. I was just captivated by these voices because I think in many ways, you know, the past is a foreign country, right? But this period for me felt so much more vibrant and relatable. I think there's something in learning about the lives of people who also live in a city, who maybe go work for that government that they don't really respect, who are having some issues with the in-laws, who feel sorrow when a relative is lost at sea. And it just really spoke to me. And I became mildly obsessed, changed my major, changed what I thought were going to be my career plans, that I really just wanted to continue to study this network and to study this part of the world. I was really interested in the act of storytelling. I wanted to look at the interplay of stories from South Asia into the Middle East and see, you know, the different ways that played out. And I just, that was my, became my bread and butter. And I started writing fictional stories inspired by that. And I think at a certain point several years ago, I thought to myself, I think this is probably financially a better choice.
You are not the first person to be entranced by the Cairo Geniza, and you will not be the last. I think for someone who's trained in the European Middle Ages, the idea that you could have an archive like that is kind of hard to wrap your head around in general. It's just such a unique collection of documents. They go so far. The number of things that they touch on is insane. But I think what you emphasize about the human aspect of that, it's an impossible experience to replicate for someone. The moment that you come into contact with real people, the one that comes to mind for me is there's a ostraca, like a little pot sherd with writing on it from Deir el-Medina, which is the little town where the builders of the Valley of the Kings live. And one of these ostraca has a record of a dispute about the use of a donkey. And these people are so mad at each other about this. And this is 3,300 years ago, if not even more. And it's not the only time that that people were mad about the rental or the borrowing of a donkey in Deir el-Medina. And like your picture of these people in the past is so much different when you're thinking about the businesswoman who has a child out of wedlock and has to renegotiate the contract, arguing about the use of the donkey, being mad at your son-in-law who can't figure out how to properly transfer the funds at the point of contact. Like, this is life. Like, these are people. And it's the most wonderful thing that you can have as a historian is to have those moments.
And I think we have a lot more of them than people realize. A lot of times when I'm doing interviews or I'm doing, you know, audience talks, I bring up some of these sources and people are quite shocked. But I do feel like we have a fair amount from this time and place. Again, if I have everything from a manual to how to trick people, then on the other side of that, this heartbreaking account of this of a doctor and scholar traveling Egypt during one of their worst famines, we do really have, I think, most of history is in the past. But every once in a while, there are just periods where the door is just flung open. And I think it's very valuable listening to people's lives from their own experience.
The metaphor I use is like the past is a darkened room. And every once in a while, somebody pops a lantern there. And you can just see so much more than you thought you could otherwise. I mean, like the third dynasty of Ur in Mesopotamia, we just have an enormous amount of information about that. And when you get into a time and place like that, what you realize is how much you're missing from everywhere else, not just how special that one time and place was. It's like, no, this is everywhere. All the time is this rich.
And I think that's humbling. I mean, if this world looks so much more different than I believed, how else might people have lived their lives? I've been reading your book, so I have it on my mind. But just talking about the societies of the Indus Valley, we are so conditioned to thinking about how civilization forms and we have our kings and we have our people on top. Well, what if it didn't? And here is proof that a society might have lived very differently and we just don't have the details, but we can see what's before us. And wow, that looks different than what we are conditioned to expect of humanity.
The limiting factor in that case is not the evidence, it's the assumptions that we bring to it. It's the way in which our preconceptions of how things are supposed to be affects the way that we read the evidence. So like the Indus Valley one is a great example of it. It's because people expected there to be a king at the top, they spent 100 years looking for a king. And the idea that there might not have to be a king just never popped up. And it turned out that the first excavators of the Indus Valley sites, who very clearly noted no king, no obvious hierarchy, they were the ones who were right. And it was everyone else who spent years trying to say, well, surely there must have been a king here. Like, no, maybe there wasn't. This brings me to Amin al-Sarafi, who is one of my favorite characters that I've encountered. You've got a strapping woman pirate. As a fan of the large folks myself, I feel a spiritual kinship with Amin al-Sarafi. Where did she come from? Where in your head did you find the makings of Amin al-Sarafi?
You know, I wish I had a really great answer because she came somewhat fully formed. On the modern side, she's very much my own conception of I wanted to write an older character in fantasy fiction. And this is not a modern problem. We like to write about the youth. And we've been telling stories about the youth for thousands of years. I get it. They're very attractive. They've don't have as much experience, so you can kind of throw situations out of them that a middle-aged person would have.
I had never thought about that angle on why people like youthful protagonists, but the number of situations that youthful protagonists find themselves in that a full-grown adult would just be like, I'm out. I want nothing to do with this.
Listen, it's a problem. It's a problem then when you write from a 40-year-old perspective, because you're just like, they would not do this. No. So I wanted to write an older character who felt more representative of myself and just who is dealing with parenthood and all the associated concerns and issues and things we say about working motherhood and working parenthood. I wanted to feel like that was some, you know, a character who was rooted in their family and their responsibilities and their duties. And then also kind of having some issues with that. I don't think this is not a historical thing, but I feel like this, I speak for many people. You don't stop dreaming once you have children. You don't stop wanting to reinvent yourself, wanting to learn new things, new skills, wanting to go back out there once you hit a certain age mark. So that was something I really wanted to capture with this character. And then just thinking about different ways of womanhood. I wanted to kind of explore what it looks like in a world where women can own property and they can divorce. That opens things up again, and just quietly, not even challenging assumptions, because I don't like to say my work is meant to challenge assumptions. It's just meant to look at a different place and look at their norms and not really say, ha ha ha, you didn't have that in Europe. But I wanted to look at, again, what it does look like when you can do those things. When I was in my early 20s, I went to this great mosque in Brooklyn where we had a sisters group where instead of learning theology, the imam would give us historical records and say, this is how the women of the past protected their rights, fought for their children, for their lives, for their community. And there were so many voices in there that 10 years later came out in Amina. It was in, you know, the noblewoman from Cairo who goes to court to argue she can marry a sailor when she's crossing the Red Sea, even though everyone's like, well, why would you marry this man? You know, like, Reasons. But now, of course, that's not what we expect of women in the past. And it was just aspects that I wanted to challenge and show and just kind of have a character that spoke back to a lot of what the male, not even just male travelers, the folklore. How much of human folklore is about the lusty sorceress, the conniving woman, the book I was talking about earlier about, you know, this sort of compendium of tricks and charlatans, it devotes a whole chapter to how women are conniving and cunning and all of that. And I wanted to have a woman who spoke back to that. So sort of the folklore and the stories and the accounts that so many male storytellers and, you know, privileged recorders of history were going to say about her.
But this is the thing that I find so fascinating and wonderful about reading your work is that because you have this command of the world, you can play with all of that in incredibly productive ways, right? Like, one of the things that I really like about it is the conflict is organic to the world, is not rooted in your imposition of like a problem to solve. It's not like a MacGuffin. It's that the characters are going through this stuff, experiencing what they're experiencing, doing what they're doing for reasons that make perfect sense within the context of that world. That's a hard thing to do. That's not easy to inhabit a world fully enough for it to make sense for the characters to have the conflicts they're having.
That was something I did really try to do. And it was something, again, I'm happy to learn from the experts. And I remember, again, having a conversation with one of the people in discussions on magic. She goes, your characters are from Oman. They're from Yemen. They're not looking to Baghdad. They're looking out to the Indian Ocean. And just kind of those constant little checks to keep it focused on their world and their problems rather than what we think their world should have looked like according to our sort of geopolitical lens.
And it's a good reminder, too, that past worlds contained multitudes, that within any given past society, there were multiple ways of being. There were subcultures in the past. People think subcultures were invented in the 20th century. Like, no, man, they weren't. Like, people have been defining themselves in opposition to or in relation to the kind of dominant cultural forms and norms forever. That's a deeply human thing to do. So like even within a past society that may have very rigid ideas, there are still going to be people who challenge those or exist outside them or are having some kind of complicated dialogue with those norms. And because you've done the research you've done, you can get at that in ways that I think are really hard for a lot of other folks.
again, that was something I was trying to work on. And it is kind of that idea of challenging norms. I know one of the issues that people got caught up on a lot and sort of assuming, oh, she's putting a modern spin on it, was the character of Jamal and elements of queerness and what we today might call a trans character. And of course, this is not a term they would have used back then. But I tell people, if you're writing historical fiction, historical fantasy, and you don't have elements of queerness, you're censoring the past. Because it's there in every single society we study. It doesn't matter what you think about it. It's there. And I was writing specifically in a time and place where we have love poems talking about specifically homosexual affairs. We have an entire idea of a separate gender. It is everywhere. So I tried to present it and show that on the page with certain of the characters in ways that felt natural to the period, and that to have not included them, let alone on a pirate ship, which is a place where people who have supposedly transgressed and can't find themselves in normal society have been fleeing to for millennia, to not have elements of that would have been its own act of censorship.
I could not possibly agree more. One of my favorite like little Instagram reels is this guy going like, inside you, there are two Greeks, one is Athenian and one is Spartan, and both are gay. It's just correct. It's just an objectively correct statement about ancient Greece. Man, gender in the past is not some traditionalist, you know, conservatives' idea of gender roles in the 21st century. It's not. Any time and place you want to go to in the past, people had ideas about gender that would shock someone in the present. The best explanation of Viking Age gender norms I've ever heard is that it's not, there's no male female binary. It is a spectrum of gender from masculine on one end to feminine on the other, and that any individual can occupy pretty much any spot on that spectrum. So many recent archaeological studies where they've gone back and retested skeletons that were sexed in one way on the basis of grave goods. And it turns out, nope, actually that person who was buried with a sword and a spear was a woman. When we import our own ideas, very specific modern ideas about gender coming from a really specific cultural place, we're going to miss a heck of a lot more than we get. And when you embrace and push that lens onto the past, you're saying a heck of a lot more about where you are in the present than you are about the actual lived reality of the past. The number of places you can go where you find people who are not conforming gender-wise, or where it's very clear, like, this person wants nothing to do with a traditional gender binary. God, that's everywhere. And different societies find different ways of channeling that and talking about it, but it does exist.
And it's fascinating. Again, I think you can just, sometimes it's okay to just look at the vast tapestry that is humanity and just sort of marvel. You don't have to, you know, immediately get up and you're like, oh, we shouldn't do things this way. Isn't it fascinating how humans have conceived of their world and their places and roles? It's just, it's amazing.
Shannon, this has been such a fascinating and wonderful conversation. I've learned so much from you about this world, and I just cannot recommend all of your novels, especially The Adventures of Amina al-Sarafi and now The Tapestry of Fate. This has been so much fun. Please come on and chat with me about this stuff again.
I would be delighted. This has been a great time.
And is there anything else you want to tell people to check out before we go?
I will just say, I often tell people this is not to shout out my own work, but because I think the time period I study is fascinating. I do very frequently on my website and on social media share books that I'm reading. On my website, I have, gosh, dozens, hundreds of sources, if you're really interested, broken down in all sorts of different ways. If you're like, hey, that sounded interesting that she was talking about, I would like to find a 13th century guide to being a criminal. I have all of that information.
Absolutely check it out. It is comprehensive. And if you are curious about this part of the world, you will find stuff to keep you busy there. Shannon Trocker-Bordy, thank you so much for coming on today. Thank you so much for writing these books. It's just an absolute pleasure.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Next time on Past Lives, we'll move a ways down the Nile from Thebes to an archaeological site we know as Amarna. 3,300 years ago, this was Akhetaten, the brand new capital of one of ancient Egypt's most enigmatic and intriguing kings. In just a few years, the religious zealot Akhenaten, Tutankhamun's father, had the new city built, but at a terrible cost to the laborers whose sweat and blood made it possible. Tune in to Past Lives to explore the lives of those Amarna workers and the world in which they lived. Thanks so much for joining me today. Be sure to subscribe to our Patreon. It's linked in the description here. The Patreon is only $7 a month, and you get tons of great bonus content, like Q&As, our book club, and much, much more. It's thanks to subscribers like you that we can make this show. If you're already a subscriber, you rule, and thanks so much. If you haven't checked out my new book, Lost Worlds, you should. It's all about prehistory and what we can learn from the distant past. You can follow me on Instagram at Wyman_Patrick or on Blue Sky at Patrick Wyman. Past Lives is written and narrated by me, Patrick Wyman. The producer is Morgan Jaffe. The music and sound design is by Gabriel Gould. This has been Past Lives.